Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic on the 101 westbound, a crash at State Route 51 blocks the left lanes. On I-10 westbound, a crash at 32nd Street has the center lane blocked. Also watch out for an accident I-10 eastbound at Ray Road. It'll be partly sunny for the rest of the day today with a high of 112. Slight chance for some afternoon rain. Same goes for tonight with overnight lows right around 90. Right now in Phoenix, mostly sunny, 107 degrees.
The Republican National Convention wraps up tonight in Cleveland as Donald Trump officially accepts his party's presidential nomination. Before Trump takes the stage, though, one of his strongest Arizona supporters, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, will address the convention.
Well, I think it's an honor to be able to help Donald Trump. I was with him from day one, and whatever I can do to help him, raring to go.
Arpaio is scheduled to speak at 5 p.m. Arizona time this evening.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block is in Cleveland for the RNC, and she joins me. And Jude, last night was supposed to be about Vice Presidential nominee Mike Pence's speech, but an earlier speaker kind of stole some of his thunder. What did Arizona delegates have to say about Ted Cruz's speech and his non-endorsement of Donald Trump?
Yeah, well, heading into this speech, you know, when I was talking to people yesterday about what they were looking forward to, I mean, even though the vice president candidate was set to speak, it was actually Cruz that a lot of these delegates wanted to hear from, because you have to remember that of the 58 delegates here from Arizona, the majority backed Cruz in the primary. And so what I heard from a lot of folks who had now come around to supporting Trump because they want to see a Republican in the White House is that they wanted to hear a really strong endorsement from Cruz. They felt like that was the pivot that they had made, and they wanted to see him do it too, in the sense of trying to unify the party and trying to win the White House. And there were a lot of people in that camp who felt very upset and betrayed. I heard from some people who said, you know, that they had voted for him, but they were now not going to support him in the future if he ever tried to run again.
Jude, are there Arizona delegates who were in the Cruz camp who share Cruz's sort of skepticism about Trump?
Yeah, and there are some in the Arizona delegation who were actually proud of Cruz. And so this is a contrasting view, who thought Trump in the primary season played really dirty. That's how they feel, that he was behind spreading misinformation about Cruz that cost Cruz the election. And so they didn't want to see Cruz kiss the ring and endorse somebody who they feel like doesn't really deserve to be the candidate. And so there are also people with that point of view in this delegation. I think it is causing a little bit of tension here.
Well, that tension probably speaks to a larger issue, which a lot of folks have been talking about this week, which is party unity heading out of the convention and into the general election. What do the delegates have to say about how this convention and what's been said and what's not been said, how that will play into the general election going forward?
Right. Well, one thing I'm hearing from everybody is this issue of party unity. And there are some people who are saying, you know, without this endorsement from Cruz, it might be a lot harder for the Republican Party to unify and be strong heading into November. There are others who are saying, you know what? Cruz really showed his true colors in a way that now he's turned off his supporters, and now they're more willing to work for Trump. So this might actually help Trump more than it hurt Cruz. So I'm, you know, there's really kind of both sides of the analysis kind of coming from the delegates and from others in the Arizona delegation that I'm hearing from. So it's kind of interesting how this will shake out.
Tonight's main event, obviously, the candidate himself, Donald Trump, will be formally accepting the nomination. I would imagine that there's a lot of anticipation both to see him on stage and to hear what he has to say in his speech.
Yeah, I mean, especially after sort of such a rocky night last night, I think there's a lot of people hoping that this grand finale will kind of smooth everything out and put them on course and kind of make up for what happened last night and sort of that angry, disappointed mood that a lot of people left with. I think people want to leave the arena happy and joyful and optimistic about November. And so they're really hoping for that tonight. You know, even yesterday heading into the night, there was, now that Trump is the candidate, there was a different mood when the convention session started. You know, people were dancing, they had a band playing. It kind of felt joyful in a way that it hadn't before, but that mood was completely sour by the end of the evening. So I think there's a lot of folks hoping to kind of get that joy back tonight.
That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reporting from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
One way to measure reaction to the goings-on in Cleveland is by what people are searching for online. Simon Rogers, Google's data editor, is monitoring that this week and says one name, not surprisingly, has dominated searches: Trump. That includes Donald, of course, but also his wife Melania and his kids. Rogers says web users are looking for answers to questions about some big issues like ISIS, race, and immigration. But he says Arizonans are also reaching for some other issues.
I would say there's a slightly higher indexing of searches around gun control in Arizona than there are in other states. And same-sex marriage is in the top five issues as well, which it is not in a few other states as well.
Rogers says Google's had real-time search data for less than a year, making this the first election in which researchers could study it. He believes it can be a helpful tool.
We're never as honest as we are with our search engine. And what that means is that you can really get at what people really genuinely care about rather than how they wish to be perceived or presented to the world. And then there's a kind of immediacy to it. As soon as something happens, we start searching. So it really gives you a very powerful social signal.
Rogers says Google searches are up 25% to 30% from the 2012 election cycle.
In the wake of civil contempt findings, some dramatic changes are on the way to the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. KJZZ's Matthew Casey has been reporting on that and joins me now. So, Matt, what overhauls to the MCSO is Federal Judge Murray Snow calling for?
So what came down yesterday was a supplement to Snow's permanent injunction, which the judge said was necessary because of Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan's failures and manipulations. The order directs Arpaio to do a complete overhaul of internal investigation policies and procedures. It moves the Professional Standards Bureau to a separate location, and they have to deliver public reports on their investigations. MCSO also has to make it easier for citizens to submit complaints against deputies, and they have to be more transparent about what the results of those complaints are. The court-appointed monitor's authority has been expanded to report on all internal affairs investigations. But perhaps most importantly, the order names two independent authorities, one with investigative and another with disciplinary powers, who will redo at least a dozen internal investigations, including several allegations of misconduct against Deputy Chief Sheridan. ACLU attorney Cecilia Wong represents plaintiffs in the case. She says the order is where the rubber meets the road.
Because MCSO, starting from the sheriff on down, has not only not held itself accountable for violating people's constitutional rights, it has subverted its internal affairs system to avoid responsibility. Today's order puts a stop to that.
Now, Matt, the sheriff has already been held in civil contempt. That's what a lot of these changes are related to. Criminal contempt could be another huge step. What could lead to that, and what are Arpaio's attorneys saying about that possibility?
There's a hearing set for Friday afternoon, and the parties for both sides are expected to argue for and against a criminal contempt referral. So we should find out pretty soon what Snow's decision will be. Attorneys for Arpaio and Sheridan filed memos this week arguing that the civil penalties, which are aimed at righting constitutional violations, are enough. They also say that neither man willfully disobeyed Snow's orders. But in the civil contempt decision, Snow wrote that their actions were deliberate.
And let's go back a few years, Matt. There was a 2013 judge's order that MCSO was supposed to comply with. How is the agency doing at this point? And does the agency have reasons for why compliance isn't a little bit better?
Snow's court-appointed monitor held a meeting Wednesday night in Tolleson. He said there that MCSO is 40% compliant with the 2013 order. But he emphasized that good faith efforts within the agency have yet to be felt in the community. The monitor's deputy said much of the order is just good police practices that have been adopted by lots of other agencies. MCSO Deputy Chief Joe Rodriguez runs the patrol bureau, and he was at Wednesday's meeting. He says the sheriff's office is moving quickly given the scope of what they have to do, and he's confident the percentage will continue to rise.
Because I know what we're doing every day. Like I mentioned, one of our missions, besides our public safety mission, is to become fully compliant with that order.
That's MCSO Deputy Chief Joe Rodriguez, and KJZZ's Matthew Casey's been here to tell us more on the possible changes coming to MCSO. Matt, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Grand Canyon University has, for the first time, set up an independent expenditure committee that'll allow for the nonprofit school, for the for-profit school to spend money on candidates and elections. Jeremy Duda, a reporter with the Arizona Capital Times, has written about this, and he joins me. And Jeremy, first off, why did GCU decide to set this up?
Well, GCU President Brian Mueller, the way he described it is that GCU has never been too heavily engaged in government relations, lobbying at the Capitol, the political world, and the need for that was kind of highlighted during this past legislative session by the failure of a major piece of legislation that the school is pushing. And obviously, this legislation, or the failure of it, was very much the impetus for the creation of this committee. And this bill, Senate Bill 1402, would have granted a massive property tax break to GCU, to for-profit higher education institutions in general, but very specifically aimed at GCU.
How much money are we talking about? I mean, how much money is in there, and how much do they expect to spend?
Well, they have put $250,000 in it. The question of how much they're going to spend, that's very much up in the air right now. President Mueller told me is they could spend all of it, they could spend none of it. He expects they'll probably spend at least a little bit of it, but at least what they explained to me is they have no immediate plans or definitive plans for how much they're going to spend or which races they're going to spend it on.
Do you get the sense that this super PAC is mostly about that property tax bill and trying to make sure that next year it passes, whereas before it failed? Or are there other issues that you think that GCU would like to try to influence at the Capitol?
Well, they tell me there are a number of other issues. One, for example, immigration reform, very important to them. Obviously, that's not so much an issue that the state has a lot of control over, but that doesn't mean the state doesn't try, as we've seen many times. But I feel like this was, obviously the motivation for this is very much the property tax. I presume they're going to be bringing that back. It's worth too much to them, and it's been too high a priority for them just to kind of leave it hanging. But if the makeup of the legislature doesn't change much, then it's not going to, it's probably not going to fare any better than it did before.
Is it in any way surprising that GCU has set up an arrangement like this?
Not really. I mean, you see many major institutions, educational institutions, business groups, unions, et cetera, anyone who has a major stake, a lot of folks who have a major stake in what happens at the Capitol have their own PACs, have their own independent expenditures. I mean, this is just kind of the way the election system works. And as GCU is kind of coming into its own as a larger and more significant institution, they are kind of looking to do the same.
In your conversations with President Mueller, did you get the sense that he's looking at this as a long-term kind of investment as opposed to just looking at this next election?
No, most definitely. I mean, a big part of his rationale for creating this independent expenditure committee is that GCU has never really been involved in the electoral politics side, has only been more minimally involved in lobbying at the Capitol and hasn't had as big a presence there. I mean, they're looking at long-term plans at what they want to do with the campus, what they want to do in the community there in West Phoenix. I think they're definitely looking at the long game here.
Jeremy Duda is a reporter for the Arizona Capital Times. We were talking about his story about Grand Canyon University's jump into electoral politics by setting up a political action committee. Jeremy, thanks.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
We hear a lot about children who end up in foster care and how much it can affect their futures. But one juvenile court judge in Maricopa County realized the best way to help those children is to help their parents. The show's Lauren Gilger takes us to Dependency Treatment Court for more.
My case, I'm telling you a little bit about me. My case originally started due to a domestic violence phone call.
Jessica Rodriguez has told her story many times.
My drug of choice was cocaine, alcohol, and marijuana.
Today, she's telling it to a few women gathered in a room at behavioral health care provider Taros for a pre-assessment group.
Every other week, I would get paid. Every other week, I would rent weekly motels.
These women are all here because a judge ordered them into treatment. They're all facing a Department of Child Safety case and allegations of substance abuse.
I lost my job in December, so that was the beginning of a cold winter. We were crashing out at a park.
And Rodriguez's story is meant to show them that success, sobriety, and reunification with their children is possible.
From the day it started, my kids were removed, 2 years later, I was granted custody of both of my children. Now it's been 2 years since all that. So I've had them both back for 2 years.
Rodriguez is now a recovery coach at Taros, but not long ago, she was in the same place as these women, ordered into treatment after police were called to the apartment she shared with her boyfriend. He was abusive, sometimes violent, and she says her neighbors called the police often.
They went to our apartment and there was no power. It was July. You know, it was hotter inside the apartment than it was outside.
She was charged with neglect, failed a drug test, and her children ended up in a foster home.
I felt shameful. You know, I wouldn't go around my family. I would literally sit on the floor holding a pillow, rocking myself back and forth, just crying. You know, I was heartbroken.
For a while, she went through the motions of getting treatment, but it wasn't until the foster family offered to adopt her daughter that she says she woke up. The judge gave her one more chance to keep her.
You know, she says, if your case manager believes in you and she feels like you deserve another chance, I'm gonna give it to you. That's when I left. I left my ex, and I told him I would do whatever it took.
She went to live in a domestic violence shelter, started working in earnest with her therapist at Taros, and started going to weekly hearings with Judge Colleen McNally.
It's a pretty friendly environment. You notice that the courtroom looks a lot different than most courtrooms, and I have to explain that when they come in. I have to tell them I'm a real judge. And
McNally is the presiding juvenile court judge in Maricopa County and runs its Dependency Treatment Court, or DTC.
The large majority of the cases that come to our child welfare system have those two components, substance abuse and neglect.
And if a parent with young children gets involved with the Department of Child Safety because of allegations of substance use, they can voluntarily enroll in the DTC program to work to get them back.
My role as the treatment court judge is to hold you accountable.
Are you taking your drug tests and staying clean? Are you participating in treatment? If you are,
you're going to get applause. You're going to get a prize. We're going to put a star on your contract. I thought, oh, these are adults. They're just going to roll their eyes and walk away. But they love that because it's recognition that they're making positive change.
I really like the structure of it.
Rodriguez says DTC gave her something concrete when everything else in her life felt out of control.
And just having that additional support, you know, on a weekly, bi-weekly basis was really helpful.
McNally launched the program in late 2012 as part of its Cradle to Crayons program for infants and toddlers in foster care. They got funding from the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors to provide services like parent-child psychotherapy, visit coaching to help parents learn how to attach to their kids, and trauma therapy for parents. McNally says most of them have experienced a lot of trauma in their lives.
Being abandoned, witnessing violence, being sexually abused, being physically abused.
Most of them, she says, were in foster care themselves when they were young.
We need to do better for these kids because that's the next generation of parents.
Now, a few years down the road, DTC is seeing results. 95% of parents who graduate from the program are reunified with their children. For parents who don't participate, only 33% are reunified.
And it's all consequences, you know?
For Rodriguez, she says DTC taught her there's a consequence to every action, a lesson she continues to pass on today.
Every choice has a consequence, whether positive or negative. You just happen to be here today.
Now in her work at Taros, she hopes she can be an example to parents who might feel like recovery and reunification are a long way off.
I'm able to provide that hope and tell them, like, it's going to be rough and, you know, it's going to seem like it's never going to end, but it will. You know, and sharing my story with them gives them hope. And that to me means a lot.
In Phoenix, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
The Arizona Secretary of State's office has published the pro and con arguments for the ballot measures voters will decide this November. And even though it's the subject of a pending lawsuit, that includes the Regulation and Taxation of Marijuana Act. We'll bring you two arguments today, one in favor and one against, starting with Sarah Mayhew. She's a public defender for the Pima County Public Defender's Office and a member of the Arizona Association for Criminal Justice. She wrote in favor of the measure. And Sarah, why do you support legalizing recreational marijuana in Arizona?
The real issue here is that prohibition has failed, just like prohibition of alcohol failed. And we need to stop stuffing our jails and prisons with nonviolent, non-dangerous marijuana users. What we know for a fact is that DUI will still be illegal. Children have nothing to do with this. We're not going to be increasing the amount of the access of children to marijuana because we know they're going to be carted just like they would if they were trying to buy alcohol. We also know that in Colorado, for example, underage use of marijuana actually decreased when they legalized it. So it has nothing to do with children.
On the issue of kids, though, you say that they will be carded for marijuana as they would be with alcohol. But obviously, underage kids do get access to alcohol, either with a fake ID or if somebody who is of age can get it for them. Are you convinced that there are enough safeguards in place so that wouldn't be the case with marijuana?
Well, that's already the case now. Only it's much safer if you're trying to go into a store and using a fake ID to try to get some alcohol, for example, than if you're trying to buy drugs from some ne'er-do-well person who's probably got a gun and it's going to go badly in some back alley somewhere. What legalizing and regulating marijuana will do is it's going to reduce crime in Arizona. It's not just going to reduce marijuana arrests, but it's going to reduce all kinds of crime.
Does it concern you some of the worries that employers have raised about the idea of workers maybe being on the job with traces of marijuana or THC in their bodies and not really being able to legally do much about that?
I think a lot of that comes from fear and misunderstanding of what is impairment and what is just a residual metabolite that is a non-impairing metabolite.
What does your gut tell you about how this initiative will play out on Election Day?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm hopeful that it will pass. I think it's something that would be a huge benefit to the state. I think it would be a benefit to reducing crime. I think it would be a benefit to reducing the overpopulation of our jails. I think it would be a benefit to stopping the mass disenfranchisement of people of color in this state. I think it would be a benefit as far as revenues without having to raise taxes. And quite frankly, what you're doing is it's a new sin tax. You're taxing people who are doing something that you're not fond of. So why not? I mean, we tax alcohol, we tax cigarettes, we tax them at higher rates. Do it.
Sarah Mayhew is a public defender for the Pima County Public Defender's Office and a member of the Arizona Association of Criminal Justice. She supports the Regulation and Taxation of Marijuana Act. Ed Gogek does not. He's an addiction psychiatrist and consults with substance abuse treatment programs. He's also written a book outlining the case against legalizing marijuana. And Ed, why should voters reject this measure?
The biggest problem with legalization is that we're going to create an industry like the tobacco companies, like alcohol, that is going to be targeting teenagers. The tobacco industry, without teenagers, they would go broke. And marijuana is pretty much the same. 90% of the people who smoke marijuana, and especially the heaviest users, start in their teen years.
Well, it sounds like you're not terribly optimistic that controls that supporters say would be in place to prevent teens from getting it would work.
They shouldn't be trusted at all. This is like the tobacco company telling us that they're going to control things. They are interested in making money. The marijuana industry has taken over the whole legalization movement, and that's who is running this.
What do you make of the argument, though, that suggests that people are already using marijuana, even though it's illegal for non-medical reasons in Arizona? And if they're going to use, it's better to buy from a regulated store where there's probably not much chance of violence if some kind of deal goes bad, as opposed to the current arrangement where it's all sort of done in the shadows.
Yeah, two things on that. First of all, the argument that people are going to use anyway is not true. We know that, especially with teenage use, and adult use too, goes way up and way down depending upon the information we give out. People actually, and especially teenagers, really respond to information on how harmful a drug is. If they hear about, because we know a lot about what marijuana does to the teenage brain, it's actually a terrible drug for teenagers to use. When they get that information, they are less likely to use it. The black market question, the question about the drug cartels, is also pretty mythical. Right now, the black market is doing very well in Colorado. Anytime you have a drug that is taxed, you know, like cigarettes, in some states, most of the cigarettes sold are sold black market, and the police spend a huge amount of time. It's a huge organized crime thing, so there's just as much problem with violent crime behind legal drugs as illegal ones. The best way to eliminate the crime is to eliminate the use.
Do you think that legalizing would have the effect that some supporters say of reducing the state's prison population by taking some nonviolent offenders out of prison and getting them treatment as opposed to locking them up?
No, and that is totally mythical, and they know that. This has been proved. There's really good research. There's barely anybody in prison just for drug possession, and especially not for marijuana possession. And I work in jails and prisons. That's part of what I do. And you just don't – you see huge numbers of drug users, but they're here because of violent acts that they committed under the influence. So that includes marijuana users. But it is not true that people are locked up just for smoking a joint.
What do you think is going to happen with this measure on Election Day?
I don't know. I'm hoping it'll be defeated. It really depends on what people hear. If people get the information on this, it would get voted down.
Ed Gogek is an addiction psychiatrist and consults with substance abuse treatment programs. He wrote against the Regulation and Taxation of Marijuana Act.
A new poll we reported on earlier this week asked residents who live along the U.S.-Mexico border for their opinions about a new border wall between the countries. 72% of U.S. respondents said they were against the idea of an expanded wall, while 86% of those on the Mexican side were opposed. So how does the concept, which presidential nominee Donald Trump has floated extensively, affect potential relations between the nations, even if it never actually comes to fruition? I'm joined by Eric Lee, executive director of the North American Research Partnership. And Eric, could even discussing the possibility of an additional border wall cause relationship issues between the U.S. and Mexico?
Yeah, I think you have to look at it at both the macro and micro levels. I think the proposal for an expanded wall, we already have a wall on our southern border with Mexico that's about 650 miles long. That wall is mostly concentrated around urban areas. So what the proposal is to complete that wall. Just that proposal is perceived in Mexico and the rest of the world as an attack on an ally and one of our primary commercial partners. Mexico is our third most important commercial partner in the world after Canada and China, and our second most important export market. The proposal, if Trump is elected, the proposal and the implementation of this would have definitely a chilling effect on U.S.-Mexico commercial relations.
When we think about longer lines, making it more difficult perhaps for people to even travel, are we talking about even at levels of tourism and not even at the greater level of trade and commerce and trucks? Could it affect all of those things?
Right. At the micro level, at the consumer level, there is a tremendous potential for a slowing of cross-border tourism, which our communities and our state and our states along the border really depend on. His comments have gotten a tremendous play in the Mexican media, and I think that as high-end retail opportunities in Mexico continue to improve, you'll find over time that a lot of people who have traditionally made a monthly or a quarterly or a semi-annual shopping trip to the United States, people will tend to stay home more and more. They'll wonder why they should go through the trouble, spend time in the long, long lines at the U.S.-Mexico border to shop in a country that really doesn't want them here.
It seems as though certainly the last year and a half, Arizona has tried to improve its relationship with Mexico in many ways, but especially in terms of commerce. And even this week, it was announced that the Phoenix Suns are going to host two of their home games, which would normally be in Phoenix. They're going to host them in Mexico in the hopes of getting more Mexican fans on board with the Suns. Does something like the potential of a new wall like this, which could cause friction at the national federal levels, does that work against individual states, individual communities, individual organizations like the Suns trying to keep those relationships solid?
I think it makes it much more difficult over time. It has tremendous potential to limit the number of these types of deals that are made at the local and regional level. You may not have a cancellation of these events, but I think more and more you'll have less and less of these events, if that makes sense, in an overall context of confrontation rather than collaboration.
Eric Lee is executive director of the North American Research Partnership. We've been talking about the possibility of an additional border wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Luz, and we're at the park in Altadena. It's a splash pad in a park, and we brought the kids, you know, because it's hot outside. They like to jump in the water, the little water things. I have a little kid who's 2 years old, and he enjoys the mini, like, elephant, and he just likes how the water comes around, and he starts telling me all this stuff in Spanish. The oldest, he likes to play video games. He can stay playing video games for a long time, and I just prefer him to come and walk around and enjoy with his friends and maybe new people and not sit at home.
That's Luz Villa at the Splash Pad at Altadena Park. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
In KJZZ News at 2:39, the State Department of Administration says the seasonally adjusted unemployment rate in June was 5.8%. That's up from 5.6% in May. This is the third month in a row the state has seen an increase in jobless numbers. Doug Walls with ADOA says the increase in jobs lost in certain sectors has a lot to do with school letting out for the summer.
As the school year ends, we see this in government, we see this in leisure and hospitality, food services, which have some contracts with the schools.
Wall says while the state lost 39,000 jobs last month, it's added 81,000 since January. Flagstaff and Prescott saw seasonal job gains in June.
The sound of drones is becoming much more common in our lives. But how we tell the drones where to go still seems a little old-fashioned. Maybe there's a joystick or a control panel. ASU professor Panos Artemiadis of the Human-Oriented Robotics and Control Lab is working to make dramatic advances that would enable us to use our minds to control the drones. And Professor, how are you trying to make this work?
So in the lab space, we are using EEG electrodes. EEG stands for electroencephalography. We're talking about non-invasive electrodes that you put on your head, essentially a cap with 128 electrodes. We record brain activity as you're thinking about multiple things. And that brain activity is essentially electrical signals. We take those electrical signals, we decode them to control behaviors for a swarm of robots, and we're sending those decisions wisely to those robots.
So what are the advantages of having mind control, other than the fact that it sounds really neat? I mean, what are the advantages to doing that in lieu of, I don't know, using buttons, joysticks, whatever?
Well, we're talking about swarms of robots. So we're talking about tens or hundreds or thousands of small robots. And if you're told to control 1,000 robots with a joystick, you cannot do that. You can control one and then have all the others follow. But this is not really collaboration among robots. When we are going to the brain, we have seen that there are specific brain areas where the activity is highly related to swarming behaviors, to collective behaviors. So if we can extract that activity, you can actually achieve more by using this brain interface than having a joystick, a keyboard, or a mouse. So essentially more degrees of freedom that you can extract from the brain in order to control a swarm, a big team of robots.
When we talk about a big team, give me an idea of what sort of number we're talking about.
In the lab, and only due to space limitations, we are controlling four quadrotors plus two ground vehicles. We're now transitioning to a bigger space, and next month we're going to be able to control 10 or maybe 20 of those robots. But definitely when we're talking about those methods can scale to hundreds or even thousands of small robots.
The mind is so powerful. I wonder if you could dig in a little bit more on what sort of patterns we're talking about here or whatnot, because I'm still struck by the fact that all our minds work in different ways. There are different parts of the brain that work differently. Does any of this depend on, I don't know, what sort of mood a person may be in? Does a person's mind have to be in a certain, for lack of a better term, mindset for this to work properly?
We're asking the subjects to relax in the beginning and maybe focus on actually controlling the robot and not doing other kinds of motions with their arms or legs or, for example, thinking about completely different things. And so we're asking the subjects not to be distracted during the task. But the nice thing about that method is that even if they are distracted, even if they are doing something completely new that we haven't seen before, we have access in real time into the brain activity. So we can say, well, this is something that we haven't seen before. So probably the subject is tired or is looking at something completely different or is thinking of something completely different. And in that case, we can extract it in real time and say, well, we're not going to send those commands to the robots because I don't think that the subject is thinking what he is supposed to be thinking.
When you think about the most positive uses for this in the future, what comes to mind for you?
Applications can vary, of course, from military to certain rescue applications where instead of sending humans to a disaster area, for example, you can send 10 or hundreds of robots to take pictures, to collect information of what's going on there, and sometimes even act on the environments to prevent something bigger happening. We're talking about exploration of, we're actually working with NASA as well on exploration, space exploration with multiple robots that are controlled by humans, of course, remotely. So all those cases where you want to send a robot instead of a human, you actually want to send multiple robots in order to collaborate. Those are the applications that I'm thinking of in the future.
What if it falls into the wrong hands? Could we see some sort of supervillain use this kind of thing?
Yes, but we are focusing on the control interface. So we're focusing on transitioning what the human wants to do to the robots. Yes, it can fall definitely on the wrong hands. But this is something that is true for any kind of technology. I mean, your keyboard and mouse can fall on the wrong hands and do some harm. What we're building is a new interface right now. And we're focusing on how this can be more intuitive, more efficient for human-robot collaboration.
ASU Professor Panos Artemiadis of the Human-Oriented Robotics and Control Lab. He's working on ways to control drones with our minds.
As water continues to be a precious and limited resource in Arizona and the Southwest, water officials continue to explore the possibility of using desalination as a way to quench the region's thirst. Tom Bouchotsky is the director of Arizona's Department of Water Resources. And Tom, what role do you think desalination will play in providing water to Arizona and the valley in the coming years?
So I think eventually this will be a significant source of water for the Phoenix metropolitan area and other parts of the state. I think we're going to use other sources first, things like additional water conservation savings, and maybe the biggest chunk of water that's out there, recycled, reclaimed water that's now being used for non-potable uses.
What has to happen for desalination to really work both technically and financially?
So the price of desalination has actually been coming down significantly over time. I think the challenges that we have within Arizona to do desalination with brackish groundwater that we have in several parts of the state is brine disposal.
What to do with the salt that comes out of the water?
What to do with the salt that's left over after you take it out of the water. There's research being done to try to concentrate that brine as much as possible, which will lower the disposal costs. But to throw out some figures, if that's okay, so brackish groundwater desalination might be in the neighborhood of $1,000, $1,200 an acre foot. The cities who treat Central Arizona Project water to potable standards are charging around $1,600 an acre foot. So that's becoming more competitive. Ocean water desalination is, you know, $2,500 per acre foot. We have opportunities potentially to partner with those who have oceans, like California or Mexico, to do ocean desal and get the water back to Arizona directly or through exchanges of other supplies that we share infrastructure with those two entities.
This is obviously not a new idea. I mean, people have been talking about desalination for a long time. There's been a plant in the Yuma area for quite a while now. Why is it, do you think, that nothing really has come of any of that so far?
Because we have not reached the point yet where our current supplies are insufficient to meet our current demands or our demands that are projected in the near future. That's one piece of the equation. The other piece of the equation is, of course, the cost. And so, again, you can find still some cheaper options. And again, both of those things will drive the timing of when the desalination actually begins.
So do you see then desalination is almost like a method of last resort if we're using everything else first and then going to desalination?
I don't know if it will be the last resort, but it will be a little bit further out in time. I think the next major direction for water treatment is going to be, again, treating reclaimed water to potable standards. There are issues surrounding there, that outcome as well. I think there is more treatment going on for reclaimed water than there is desal across the United States. Again, it's a price thing, and it will, when those two lines kind of cross, you'll see more desal increasing over time.
Do you have sort of in your mind a timeline of when we might start to see some of these ideas come to fruition? We might start to see desalinated water coming into Arizona?
So Scottsdale already desalinates their reclaimed water to put it on the golf courses, the high-end golf courses. The city of Goodyear is already desalinating brackish water. So I think you're going to see it on smaller scales like that in local areas where they have a specific need or a specific water quality need like Scottsdale. On larger scales, maybe it's a couple decades away, but I think some of that's going to be targets of opportunity. And if we can create a deal with either California or Mexico, maybe Mexico's first in line, we'll probably do that, and maybe it'll be a demonstration project to start and then upscale from there.
Tom Bouchonsky is the director of the State Department of Water Resources. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The writer Lindy West is not afraid to bring up complex topics like sexism, racism, and abortion. She's probably best known for being part of what's called the Fat Acceptance Movement, which is trying to change social attitudes toward weight. West was in Phoenix last night to promote her new book, Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman, and KJZZ's Sina Sieg was there.
One of the things that West really focused on was using humor to help bring up topics she thinks that we need to talk about more.
You know, it's a lot easier to get someone to read an article about something kind of challenging like feminism or, you know, like maybe we should be nice to fat people, you know, things that people aren't used to hearing and maybe don't want to hear. It's a lot easier to get them to read those things if you make the article really funny. And then people just send it around and say, hey, read this funny article. And then secretly, you are consuming some tougher notions that you might not otherwise seek out on your own.
It's like being a ninja.
Yes. Or I think about it as like when you have to give your dog a pill, so you hide it in some peanut butter or ham.
You know, a lot of the work that I know you for is talking about self-acceptance and body positivity and kind of, you know, changing how you see fatness and how the culture sees fatness in general. Do you feel like you're going to have to be talking about this forever, or do you think we're going to reach this point where you're not going to have to bring this up anymore because people are going to be like, oh, of course, that's just another way a body could look?
I mean, I don't know. I hope that I don't have to write about it forever because I already feel like I'm writing the same article over and over and over that says, it just says, please respect me and my humanity and treat me like a person. And there's only so many ways you can say that. But it is a challenging concept for people. People have a lot of, you know, a lot at stake, a lot of self-esteem and self-worth wrapped up in this notion that thin people are better people than fat people.
Do you find that even though you've made that transition to, you know, loving your body and loving who you are at this moment, that you still have to remind yourself?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that's a major flaw in the term body positivity or fat positivity, because it puts this expectation on people that they have to feel positive all the time, which is just not realistic. And it sets up the situation where people not only feel bad about their bodies, then they feel guilty for not doing body positivity good enough. You know, like that's just an extra layer of shame and unhappiness that I don't feel like I want to put on people, you know? Like what I want to do is abolish these societal expectations that say if you have a body that deviates from this one very, very specific ideal, then you're garbage and that and you need to apologize and you need to torment yourself. That's what I want to get rid of. I want to get rid of those external pressures. And then people can, you know, within that, feel however you feel. I just don't I don't think that society should dictate people's sense of self.
And that was Stina Sieg with author Lindy West. Stina, you were there last night. How did the atmosphere at the event fit into what Lindy was talking about in your conversation?
You know, it fit in really well. You know, there was such a supportive, friendly vibe between all the women, really communal. And I overheard a lot of women talking to Lindy personally, basically saying, the message that you're sending is something that I really needed to hear.
Stina, thanks.
Thank you.
As parents prepare to send their children off to college in the fall, many are concerned about their kids' safety. 1 in 4 female college seniors has experienced sexual assault on campus. That's according to a recent survey by the Association of American Universities. A warning to listeners, this story contains a description of such an attack. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
Jean Escara was a college student when a young man approached her in New Orleans and invited her to a party. She said yes, but instead of going to a party, he lured her to a parking garage.
I think I knew in my gut, wow, this really doesn't feel right. You know, he was trying to kiss me, you know, put his hands everywhere, and I'm trying to physically get away. I really fought and bit his arm, and, you know, he ended up strangling me. I wasn't actually conscious for the attack.
When she came to, he was gone. She picked up her clothes and ran for help. Escara found a police officer who helped her go through the rape kit process. Years later, when she lived in Flagstaff, the FBI found a DNA match, and she was able to press charges and put the guy away for 40 years. She's one of 20 million women in the U.S. who will be raped in her lifetime, according to Justice Department statistics. Jacqueline Rose felt completely helpless when her teenage sister was sexually assaulted in Florida. Then it happened a second time.
We were living in Weston, Florida. It was one of the safest neighborhoods in America, very suburbia. Both times, she was less than 2 miles from our house.
Rose had an idea. What if her sister could just press a button to get help? So she designed one. It's called Revelar, which means to fly again in Spanish. The device is small, 2 inches long, and clips under your clothes or on a keychain. 2 clicks sends an alert with your GPS location to friends or contacts of your choice. 3 clicks indicates you need 911 help now. Rose is just a couple years out of college. She thought millennials might be more comfortable reaching out to friends than to the police, and they could use it to get out of a bad date or a boring meeting.
We built this for us, right? Like, we were our own target demographic.
Rose and her co-founder launched a Kickstarter campaign almost 2 years ago. Then they convinced venture capitalists to pitch in $3 million. Once she found the tech-savvy people to build a prototype, the next step was finding a manufacturer and a retailer. In May, it was picked up by Brookstone and now sells for $99.
It was a lot of naive confidence and sheer persistence of will. Like, I was just like, of course this is going to happen. It needs to happen, and somebody is going to help me make it happen.
20-year-old Alana Sudkamp sits outside her grandmother's home in Tucson. She'll be a junior at the University of Arizona in the fall. And she says there are many occasions when she finds herself in vulnerable situations.
When you're going to the library during finals and stuff, and you're there till, you know, 3 in the morning, and you have to walk back to your car.
Sudkamp says it's not always convenient or easy to call a friend, so a button like this would be useful.
Some people feel, not pressured, but they don't feel like saying no to guys and stuff. So I know, like, some girlfriends who they would leave after the party and, like, go back to their place, but they really didn't want to, you know, and they didn't know how to get out of the situation, and so...
So she likes how discreet a button would be. But Jean Escara, the woman assaulted at 19 in New Orleans, she's not sure if Revelar would have helped her.
I don't know if I could have done it without drawing attention, you know, when we were down on the ground, maybe.
And Escara worries the device might give some people a false sense of security and possibly put them into a dangerous situation.
Oh, I'm going to be okay because I have this little device that isn't going to protect you from somebody who moves very quick.
Even if you have technology that makes you feel safe, she says all young women must be aware that predators exist, be vigilant, and always trust your intuition. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.